Mini episode 165 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by LaughAtSports.com, your new internet home for the convergence of athletics and comedy. Follow them on the web at LaughAtSports.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
All right, folks, we're here for FDH Lounge mini episode number 165. Rick Morris here for the FDH Lounge. Being hosted today by the gracious folks at Alley NYC, and back on the program for the third time, first time we've been able to do this in a face-to-face setting. Very pleased to be able to bring back on the show CodeFab CEO Alex Cohn, who has become a valued friend of the program and voice on all things technology. We're going to be talking about a lot of that with him today. Alex, thank you so much for being back on with us, sir.
Thank you for having me. It's really great to be back on. It's an exciting time with lots of interesting changes in the air.
There really are, and along those lines, actually, the very newsworthy thing in the last couple of days, the Mars rover landing, and I happened, as I was just reviewing through some bio information here, something that stuck in my mind, because I'm from the Cleveland area, which is a big NASA town, and I understand you actually did work at NASA back in the day. What was the nature of your work?
Well, I worked, fortunately, not in Cleveland,
okay,
but nearby New Orleans in the Michaud Assembly Facility. I worked on the space shuttle. I worked on there's a huge facility outside New Orleans in Louisiana where they assemble the external fuel tanks, and they once built the Saturn V rockets. And so I wrote software that coated the outsides of the fuel tanks with heat shielding and paint and, you know, stuff that burned off during ascent. And it was very, very exciting working for NASA back in those days. Of course, a little sad because we were planning on 100 launches a year at the time, but it was very exciting to be part of it. And at that point, we had only just landed one probe onto the surface of Mars and taken pictures. And I remember we had a big picture of that up on the wall. So it's very exciting to be going back to Mars with an unbelievably complicated insertion routine. And it was really fun watching everybody at JPL jumping up and down and screaming and slapping each other's hands after it successfully landed, and seeing that absolutely every single person who had a laptop there had an Apple laptop.
100%, huh?
Yep. We joked that the guy jumping up and down the hardest was actually the local Apple salesperson.
Yeah, probably. But that was, that was really something to have seen that come about. But as you indicated, there are so many different things that are going on here in 2012 in the technology world. We're actually at a place here, Alley NYC, and we had spoken with their CEO earlier, Jason Saltzman, about a hackathon that they did over the weekend, and I understand that that's been standard practice with you and with CodeFab. You guys have been very much holding those yourselves.
Yeah, we hold a hackathon every year. It started out as a an iPhone, then an iPad, then a mobile, and so now we have it's a mobile mobile technologies related hackathon, and we come up with a different theme each year. So this year was the cloud was our big theme of the hackathon, and everybody had to do cloud computing as a component of their or cloud storage as a component of their solution, and it was a great hackathon. We had a bunch of media presence, including two television crews, one based out of New York and one from South America. So it was sort of almost like a reality show with, tiptoeing around talking to different groups with big microphone over my head and the camera guy snapping pictures or taking video. And it was very cool. I mean, I think the cloud as a concept is a really technology that's coming of age. It's been around for a long time with both computing and storage, but in order for this to become a component of everyday technology, it has to be a component of the technology that, not just technical people would use, but your mother would use, that somebody without even thinking about it, has stuff that's stored in the cloud. And Apple's really coming a long way towards making that sort of a ubiquitous part of the technology that people use on a daily basis. With their latest Mountain Lion, if you have an iCloud account, you go to save a regular file, you have an option to save it in the cloud. And this is part of this transition that Apple is really pushing to move away from desktop computing And this is the sort of a second wave. The iPhone and iPad get people used to sort of computing on the go and computing without having keyboards and, you know, mice. And what this is getting you to do is computing without having to worry about where your stuff lives. When in my keynote for the hackathon, you know, I compared cloud storage to a bank. This is a bank where you store your digital stuff. You know, you store your money in a bank and not in your mattress, because let the bank take care of having guards and vaults and let them take on the responsibility for making sure your money is there tomorrow when you come back. And as a result of giving the money to them to hold on to and store for you, you can access it electronically. You can access it when you're on the road. You know, you could do all kinds of things with that. Whereas if it was all in your mattress at home, if you're on the road and you need some of that money, you're in real trouble. You can't always just keep stuffing it in your pocket every time you go. And it's having files on your hard disk on your home computer is sort of like that. I'm on the road. Gosh, I better stuff this into my pocket before I go. And if I have to find some way to get back to that stuff on my in my mattress and get it when I'm on the road, it's really sort of a pain. Whereas if everything lives all the time in this magic cloud bank for your digital stuff, you can access it from your phone, from your tablet. And when you're working on a presentation on the train on your way into work, and you get to work, you know, you close up whatever you're working, what device you're using to work on it while you're on the train, get to work and sit down at your desk, and you have access not to a copy of the document that you've synchronized somehow, but it's the same document. You know, and it's moved stuff away from your desktop PC. And you know, Apple is really strongly invested in, and a number of other companies that are really looking towards the future are strongly invested in sort of a post-PC universe where we stop having, you know, strictly speaking, full-fledged standalone personal computers, but the computer stuff that you have at home is like some peripherals on computing that maybe walks around with you and storage that is available to you everywhere. And these are just, you know, things that help you access it, but they're not independent computing things. And if you think about it right now, you can tell that we're at this transition point because everybody has too many computers. You know, you're walking around and you've got a laptop and an iPad and an iPhone in your backpack, and you get home and there's another desktop computer. Maybe you've got a computer in the living room that you store a bunch of media files on, and then your wife has got a computer and she's got an iPad, and you spend a lot of time thinking about how do I get this particular PDF file or this music file from one place to another. And that is in the process of going away. Over the next year or two, you know, certainly in the Apple universe and in a number of other universes, you will simply have that PDF file or that music file, and it doesn't matter what you wear, you'll be able to access it. And maybe you'll have a cached copy locally for faster stuff, but the computers will take care of making sure that the stuff you use most is local. And it's not just Apple that's doing this. I mean, this is, you know, Microsoft and Google and others are investing, and, you know, Dropbox are investing in various slices of this technology. But it all has to come together and work well together so that nobody has to think about it the way you used to when you said, I need a cloud storage directory that I'm going to go put stuff in. You know, it's just, that's just the way you do it. Just like you don't really think about banks and ATMs anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's really moved that way. And cloud storage stuff is like a bank, too, because if you don't like Bank A, you don't like Chase Bank, you know, you can take your money out and put it into Citibank, and it works much the same way with your digital stuff. If you don't like having this particular cloud storage, you know, you should be able to take it out and put it in a different cloud storage and still be able to have access to it in a comfortable and, you know, 24/7 fashion. And they take care of making sure it's backed up and, you know, the servers it's on are suitably redundant, because anymore, you know, you don't want to know about security guards in vaults in order to store your money.
Right.
And so I think the transition from, you know, discrete computer-based computing and discrete, you know, personally managed storage to this sort of ubiquitous computing, you know, on the go, wherever you happen to be, and ubiquitous storage and ubiquitous access to your storage is really very exciting. I mean, it's taken a lot of factors, not only the technologies, but, you know, bandwidth and disk space, you know, in order to make this work. And over the coming years, when you'll be able to find fat Wi-Fi everywhere you go for free, that, you know, your you know, phone will have even more power than it had before. You know, it's going to get, you know, this is going to become easier and easier. And just the same way a couple years ago, streaming a movie via Netflix from the web was, you know, complex and painful process if you could do something like that at all. Now, you know, everyone expects that if you got a Netflix account, you can be sitting on your bed with your iPad watching a movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a truly revolutionary precept, and I have to say, and for personally, as somebody who who's not the most tech-savvy person, I've not used the cloud much myself, so I'm really looking forward to the ability to do that with my countless amounts of files that I have that I would certainly like to be able to put there. I know also, too, the last time that you were on, we were talking about this because you mentioned about tablets and using them as a sort of a bridging device here, sometimes with home entertainment and with shows coming from tablets to the TV. There was a development that we saw the other day that actually concerned a friend of ours, somebody that we've had on the show also a number of times, Jim Louderback from Revision 3, and with them being purchased now by Discovery Communications. And I'm starting to wonder, is it a thing that where you're seeing entertainment platforms with new media that are increasingly going to be incorporated with existing large media platforms? When you see something like that happening, it indicates that on the entertainment end of the industry also that you probably have a convergence that's coming. Are you kind of seeing the same thing?
Well, yes, and this speaks to a personal project that I've been working on, which is sort of digital entertainment in the home. You know, I have set up a complicated setup in the living room of my house that allows for all kinds of locally stored stuff, streaming stuff, TiVo, Apple TV, and it's marvelous. You know, but really only I can use it. So part of the thing is both to find a way to reduce the confusion of having 37. My Blu-ray disc player will stream Netflix movies. So if somebody sits down in my living room, they have four different devices that they could turn to if they wanted to watch Netflix, and that's confusing. If somebody wants to just sit there and watch the news, it can be somewhat complicated. So I think we're in a situation where something has to happen whereby this stuff can go back to being, in some way, shape, or form, simple for you to just go access it from one point, and you can access it without having to worry about which of the many different sources you can pull from. This is going to be, I think we're going to end up with something that, some interface, and I'm sure that Apple thinks that they're going to find a way to do this, where you can go to a single thing and say, I want to see, the latest episode of, Falling Skies, and, whether it is stored on recorded on my TiVo, whether it's coming up in an hour on broadcast TV, whether it can be rented from, at iTunes, or it's available on Hulu Plus, I shouldn't have to care. The system should just find it and maybe tell me what my options are about watching it now versus setting it up to be watched tomorrow, and just make it happen. And there should be a way this could all be sort of centralized and, accessed without having to think about it being different. If people really want to say, I want to watch the Olympics, and I don't want to think about, finding it amongst a thousand channels or finding some way to see, some event that was in London 5 hours ago, recorded somewhere in cache, they want to just basically ask for stuff and find it. We're getting to the stage where the diversity and quantity of content is almost overwhelming to most people, and we need to come up with a way to have a better organizational, a better access front end on it.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be a little bit overwhelming, really, to try to sort through the devices and to try to get to the programming that you're looking for. And I'm wondering if this possibly ties anything into it, or if this might be more on a business note. I'm fortunate to have here some notes between you and our senior producer, Steve Cervillo, about today's discussion here. And you noted in here something about this being the year of the digital assistant. So can you elaborate a little bit on what that means?
Well, I think Apple, in addition to initially with the iPhone getting everyone comfortable with using a powerful computer without an actual physical keyboard, is really trying to address the problem of accessing this wealth of content in a more human-oriented, natural fashion. There's lots of cool things about their Siri digital assistant, but the primary thing that drives this is that instead of you as a technology-savvy person thinking, okay, if I run this query on Google and then I use this tool and that tool and this other tool, I can solve a problem. You ask a question in terms of a human term, in terms of what you want. I want a reservation at 8 o'clock at a Greek restaurant near my house. And how that request is solved, what the pieces are to make that happen, gets handled by the servers at Apple and the Siri mechanism itself. And that allows for the back end to be updated as new tools and technologies come in, as new sources of data come in, and as they get better and better at understanding, people in general and you in specific, as they learn more about your personal habits, they can do a better job of answering it. So you end up having something that is very much like having a digital assistant, and you can speak to it, in a way that is meaningful to you, not in a way that is meaningful to a search engine or something else, and it will do a much better job of trying to solve that. We're not quite at the stage where, you know, I think you can text while driving, but we're moving in that direction. And certainly a lot of stuff can be done relatively simply with this. And I think it's the year of digital assistant because the concept of a digital assistant has really strongly entered people's consciousness. And this is a first step towards a broad acceptance. You know, we're not even quite there with the cloud, but we're starting to be. But with the digital assistant, you know, you get all these famous actors talking into their phones and getting things to happen in a way that's miraculous, or seemingly miraculous, because I'm really not sure that Martin Scorsese could actually talk to Siri quite like that. But, nonetheless, it gets people used to the idea that they could, you know, not just use their fingers to talk to a computer, but they can use their voice to talk to a computer. And it goes from voice requests and voice commands to an interactive dialogue, which is even more interesting, mm-hmm. when it can come back and ask you to clarify or give you some results, and then you can go further. So you have a multi-step process, which is just coming in, to, you know, be able to say, come home and say, turn on some music, and it knows what you like and puts on, you know, some classic blues or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this is the year, I think, where this concept enters people's consciousness and becomes a component of how people deal with powerful computing and powerful digital storage at a level that is so basic that they stop thinking about the miraculousness and the power behind all of this. And it can get refined and perfected after this. But, you know, it is also indicative of big companies duking it out for, you know, ground in a landscape most people aren't really aware of. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the more interesting aspects of Siri is that instead of beforehand you would go in and maybe do a Google search, get search results back, and then use a specific thing for getting a reservation. Now you ask Siri about, you know, finding that Greek restaurant, making a reservation, and you aren't saying ask Google.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Siri can go ahead and use whatever search engine it feels is appropriate, and you build up a loyalty and a connection to the Siri digital assistant, not to the underlying technologies. So Apple can swap in their own technologies instead of Google's if they want.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is part of a larger scale turf war for this sort of more virtual computing. This is
mm-hmm.
I think this is related to the same reason that the iOS 6 is going to be shipped relatively Google free. You know, not only is it not going to have Google Maps, it no longer has YouTube as an installed application, which was the last, you know, hardwired to a service owned by Google component of the iOS.
Mm-hmm.
So while you'll still be able to get Gmail, go to Google, get Google Maps, anything else like that on the phone, it doesn't ship with an application specifically wired to a technology from Google. And I think this is because Apple wants to control, you know, the user experience that you connect to. And so as more and more of the computing life and that they're selling to and they're providing tools for becomes virtual, becomes mobile, they want to be the one that you talk to first. And, you know, they're looking for every little bit of leverage and to, you know, control the branding and the delivery of those services. And so, you know, it's an interesting, you know, battle that's being fought sort of out of sight of most people, but it's for this next generation of post-PC computing that, you know, they're getting footholds on all sorts of areas that will benefit type of computing that we're just beginning to see hints of today.
Well, it's always very illuminating whenever you have the behemoths like that, Google and Apple, that are kind of squaring off here, and as you indicated, with some of the apps not shipping on the phones subsequently here, and that can't necessarily sit well with Google. But it's always part of an interesting slice of the ecosystem here with the companies that are just coming up. What are you seeing as far as some of the more consequential startups, social media companies in the last year or so, that are really making an impact on the scene?
Well, certainly my mother's done fairly well investing in Nuance, which is the voice recognition technology behind Siri. You know, I think that, you know, as we move more into this sort of, you know, mobile, you know, marketplace, lots of tools and technologies we used to use to do, once we stopped going shopping by going into the store and started going shopping by using our computer, and then now we're doing shopping where we make decisions about what we're going to buy on the go, but still using computing, you're still using our phone or, you know, our tablet, whatever. The ability to get sort of up-to-date, crowdsourced information about what to buy, what's hot and what's not, you know, where the traffic is, anything else like that, increasingly becomes of value. And so I think companies that are feeding into that are very hot. They have to find the right kind of traction and metric. It's a difficult area. All the social stuff is very difficult to get into because you have to hit it right and blow up big. Otherwise, you just simply don't have enough people on there providing enough information for you to be interesting. Now, you could have a better service, but if somebody else has got more input into their crowdsourced information, then they're more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also speaks to the fact that so much of the services, they get advertising or they get revenues from sort of secondary tie-ins, that finding a way to get that information in front of more and more people and controlling access to those eyeballs becomes increasingly important. And it's an ongoing battle because that's somewhat at odds with technologies like Siri, because I could sit there and make that reservation for my dinner tonight, and I won't have actually looked at a computer screen. So if there were Google ads, if the Open Table making the reservation had ads on it, I wouldn't see those.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, lots of this stuff is funded by such sources of income for the service providers, and if the tool chain, if the connection between me and my ultimate goal doesn't involve an opportunity to pay in for that, then those guys don't get paid and ultimately are in danger of going out of business. So a lot of the scrabbling is to try and find a way to monetize things in new and interesting ways, because the old ways of having ads on web pages isn't working anymore. Just people are increasingly not going to web pages where those are,
mm-hmm.
and certainly not clicking through. I think mobile advertising is still somewhat of a challenge, but even then, what value is a mobile ad if I'm not going to actually look at my phone and tap on things? I'm going to talk to a voice interface to go do stuff. Having mobile ads popping up in various places, I'm not going to see those because I have a voice interface on this.
Mm-hmm.
And the danger, of course, is that we'll end up with Bluetooth contact lenses and we'll have ads for credit cards floating in space in front of our eyes, which would be very annoying.
Well, I know that there might be folks looking at it on a consumer level who may not understand the gravity of what you just said, because they're just looking at it from the point of view of not having to view ads and that being a good thing. But the economics of this thing have to continue to be self-sustaining. You have to be able to have something where people are able to monetize and keep their businesses afloat. So I personally can see the importance of what you just pointed out there.
And a lot of these, the latest stuff, things like Pinterest and things mm-hmm. like that, are speaking directly to the sort of augmented reality universe this mobile computing talks to. If we can have if we are frequently using maps and sort of meta information about the environment around us on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
you want to have as much information as possible. I mean, I remember when I was younger, there was a great show on MTV called Pop-Up Videos, which is I haven't watched MTV in a long time, but they had this great thing where they'd show some music video, and there'd be little balloons that popped up around various things in the thing saying, they rented this fire engine for the day but ended up blowing it up and it cost them $500,000 or little backstory. And so I always sort of wanted to walk around the world and have little pop-ups, see somebody with a funny haircut and you wish there's a little balloon over their head said, their barber hates them for this reason or whatever. And things like Pinterest and these augmented reality things actually provide a way in which you could be looking at two identical stores on a block and basically pull up a little pop-up that says these guys are having a sale, or this is the hot place and that place has rats in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
And and this is basically feeding into a new ecosystem of being able to access and find and make decisions based on information that you get at real time while you're out in the world. And the technology is going to continue to come along to find a way to get that information to you, but the information providers are trying to get started early with giving that information. And I don't know about you, but even now I find when I'm using some Google map or whatever, I could zoom all the way in and it'll show me that there's some shop associated with some building.
Mm-hmm.
But I click on the name of the shop and it doesn't do anything because the parts of this thing that is the mapping service are different from the parts of this thing which is doing Google Places with actual information about stores in the universe, and
mm-hmm.
I haven't got that tied together yet. And that's indicative of opportunity, shall we say.
Yes.
And, you know, there's room to grow heavily in this environment as the technology comes along to make that information ever more, you know, presentable to the people and ever more valuable to the people presenting it.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, again, everything that you're discussing with that, you know, it's something that, you know, I've been noticing as a relatively new iPhone user myself, and just in trying to get my head around all the different things with it, too. They really do need to get things like Google Maps integrated a little bit more with some of the different features and everything. I think you're clearly right about that. But you are a guy, and we've been talking about this in your previous times on the show also, who is very good at helping people unlock the potential of the iPhone, the iPad, among other devices here. And I understand that the book that you're writing is called Modern Cocoa Programming, Writing Apps for Mac OS X in the Age of the iPhone. So can you talk a little bit about that and what you've got coming up?
Well, it's been very interesting. When we first started writing programs for the iPhone and the iPad, it felt like a significant evolution from the technologies that had been used to write programs for the Macintosh. And in fact, it was. I mean, it was designed as a sister product. It had to work with touch. It had to have different, you know, aspects, different strengths and weaknesses. The actual, you know, resources available to a program on a computer are different between a mobile device and a desktop device. And they built that in at a fairly fundamental level. But they also learned a lot of lessons there that they can bring back to the Macintosh in terms of how to do things better. Because, you know, one of the pluses of having such a success with the iPhone and the iPad is a huge inrush of people who are developing applications for it, mm-hmm. you know, far more than had been developing applications for the Macintosh, and they had to come up with ways to make it easier and more foolproof, even though the actual product was actually harder to create than a desktop application because it had to work while you were in line at Starbucks. And so they have tremendously taken from the iPhone and the iPad programming experience and brought that back to the core Mac programming experience to the extent that you can write a tremendous amount of code that will work on both platforms. And they've also taken a lot of thinking about how to do a better job of programming on a mobile device and made that available to the Macintosh. And they've reinvented a lot of the underpinnings. Apple has moved tremendously forward now with their development environment, with their compiler, with the core Objective-C language, with the frameworks that are available to you, and now give you on a desktop environment access to gestures and lots of animations that you had on the phone are now, you know, see those on the desktop as well. And this is part of the fact that, well, they're not going to converge into a single operating system. Different sets of peripherals, different size factors have different tools that are better for them.
Mm-hmm.
But nonetheless, a number of metaphors people will expect to be consistent across these platforms. And as we move into this sort of post-PC era, where when you get home, you more or less have better peripherals. You know, you have a new key, you have a physical keyboard and a big monitor, but you're still talking to the same computing, same programs. You're going to expect things to be more consistent and behave in a similar fashion. And resources that you had on the road, you would expect to have at home and vice versa. And so this has involved a rethinking of basically how you program as well as what you program. And there seemed to be a tremendous opportunity to write a book starting now with, you know, Mountain Lion and the latest tools going looking forward, rather than writing a book that said, here's the 15 ways that they tried in the past that they don't really use anymore. And so we call this modern Cocoa programming, and it uses the latest versions of the languages that you use to program, the latest versions of the tools, you know, amazing stuff that they've added into Mountain Lion and the development environment. And it's an opportunity to basically write a whole new book on how to program for the Macintosh. And ultimately, I think it's going to be part of a series about how to write code that works across these platforms and how to optimally write code for this post-PC era. But we get to write code that, you know, starts from the get-go with cloud storage as a fundamental aspect of it, with easy animations and with gestures. You know, with dictation as a standard part of what you're doing, you know, with Retina displays, and, you know, now with the Mac App Store and, you know, sandboxing and signing of applications and doing in-app purchases for Mac apps, much like you can do with an iPhone app, this is an enormously new world, and it changes, you know, basically if you have to come up with what are the 10 topics you want to copy, you cover in a beginning programming book, that list is fundamentally different than it would have been 2 years ago. So I'm trying to be the first one out of the gate with a book on, you know, programming in this new age for the Macintosh.
Well, that's a great way to be positioned if you can be the first one out of the gate, and it sounds like that'll be the case here. And again, going back to what we talked about earlier in the conversation with cloud computing sort of as a unifying principle of all of this with the different devices. So even for somebody who doesn't know as much about tech as me, I can kind of grasp the picture that you're painting here, as I would guess that a lot of the listeners probably could as well. So that's obviously one major project that you've got going on there with CodeFab, Alex. But we always like to give our guests a chance to hit really anything else sufficiently here. So anything that we didn't talk about sufficiently, we hit the hackathon and some of the great projects with CodeFab. But anything we didn't hit sufficiently, please take it away, sir.
Well, most of our work these days is coming at sort of the higher end, sort of the enterprise-level mobile computing. This has been very interesting. We've seen a number of phases in mobile computing. You know, we probably started out with sort of mom-and-pop operations that wrote little applications because businesses weren't that interested in this stuff, and small people had an opportunity to do stuff. And they more or less ran out of money and opportunity and were overtaken by what I call the agency era, where we had design firms were convincing their clients that they needed iPhone applications. So you had lots of branded iPhone applications from this TV show or that vodka or this magazine or whatever else. I think when there was a P. Diddy application, that one had really jumped the shark. And then finally we're moving into the era of enterprise computing, where mobile computing becomes a fundamental part of how these companies do business. One of my favorites is Zipcar, which really couldn't exist without the whole mobile computing aspect of this. You just whip out your iPhone, say, I need to rent a car. And it says, here's these 20 cars right around you within a block or two. And I can walk in and tap on the window with my Zip card, and the door will unlock. I get in and drive off. And I don't have to see some surly person behind a counter with a dot matrix printer who needs to see my driver's license and credit card again, even though I have a corporate account at Avis. Don't you actually record any of this anywhere? And then I don't get to choose which car I get or anything else like that. And so Zipcar has really, written their business plan with mobile, in their DNA. And so they have applications that are fundamental to their business, that are free for the end user, but are written at a higher level. Similarly, we're doing a lot of work in digital publishing. We've done work with Barnes & Noble and other people to put information out there. And again, the actual reader end is like a tail on the end of the dog. It has to be a wonderful experience, but it's tied into a huge corporate infrastructure for delivering that, delivering it securely, doing e-commerce with that, and so forth. And increasingly, this is where the interesting parts of our business are, as businesses slowly come online with this as part of their business plan. I mean, we're just a little bit ahead of where like the web was in the late 90s, where you had banks going, what would we do with a website? Put our phone number on it? and they couldn't believe that we'd be where we are today, where you do all your banking electronically and you never see a teller. And we're getting that kind of transformation in the business market now, as people slowly fold that in. And people like us who do this very high-end digital mobile computing and know about things like security and scaling to lots and lots and lots of users and integrating with lots of other systems, are a real rarity. And we have the advantage of having been doing it for a long time. Interestingly, we find that a certain amount of our competition is sort of disappearing out from underneath us. I had some good friends of mine who had a company that was also involved in hackathons called Small Society out on the West Coast. They got bought up by Walmart. Walmart decided they needed a good in-house mobile applications team, and they bought this iPhone programming company, lock, stock, and barrel, so that they could get the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really quite amusing. Another company I know up in Seattle got bought by Deloitte Touche because they needed a mobile application development team. And so I just got scooped up as sort of a brain trust grab. So anyone out there who's got a really large amount of money and needs a really good mobile development team, you can always call me at CodeFab. abc@codefab.com. No offer is too big.
That's something I hadn't heard before. Large companies like that basically using these firms as basically feeder systems for their own IT uses. I mean, I'd never heard of that before, but I guess that makes all the sense in the world from their point of view. And if they're wanting to buy up folks that have the expertise and have proven that they can do it. But we know from having talked to you previously, a preeminent firm in the business able to do this, CodeFab. And it is always a pleasure to be able to speak with you, Alex. I know that you're able to explain this in a way this modern world and the way that it's evolving in a way that makes sense to all of our listeners. And we greatly appreciate having you on once again. Thank you so much, Alex.
It was my great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.